I thought, you know, when you're a keynote, there's a lot of pressure to, like, deliver a seamless talk. And that would have required me to write out a bunch of stuff and then read from it, and I didn't want to do that. I jotted some notes. And what I'm going to give you are basic impressions that I've had over the last year from the land as I'm trying to puzzle out this whole thing about, I wouldn't even say it's about water. It's certainly not a chronicle of drought that I'm writing. This is a book that I'm doing for Knopf Random House. I swore I would never delve into water again after the King of California. You know, I got to write an index, bibliography, notes to chapters. I want to not do any of that. I'm hoping that I can write it in a way that's literary, but reaches people who are obviously outside this room who know nothing about water and what we've done with it. And so it's a challenge. And I'm not even sure where I'm at. You're catching me midway into this thing. The book has to be written and delivered in February. And so I'm just in the middle of it all. The documents have morphed. They've gone from my office to the kitchen, and now half the bedroom is stacked with engineering reports back to 1875. And I'm looking for nuggets out of them, you know, things that help tell the story. My colleagues, former journalists, I have a very close friend who just won a Pulitzer Prize for her beautifully wrought stories on everyday people in the drought. Diana Markham of the LA Times, who took over my job when I left the LA Times in 2007. But the stories are called California's Dust Bowl. And then I have a friend named Matt Black, who was a young, incredible photographer. This is the Dorothea Lange of our day. And Matt and I spent a lot of time documenting the Black Okies and then the Trique Indians. But Matt got his photos in the New Yorker, and it was essentially California's Dust Bowl, paradise burning. And if you look at those images and you read the stories, you get a sense when you're coming to this place that it is just dry as hell. And it's not. I mean, I've been driving up and down the valley, and yes, there are patches of dry, but there's always patches of dry. There's land fallowed all the time. There's more land fallowed now, but really, there's no Dust Bowl. And so how do you capture this drought, the rain not falling, the snow not melting, and yet things humming along just like they always do? Well, some of that we can explain by the extraction of groundwater, which I was interested to hear about just before, you know, this morning. But I think we need to, and what I'm hoping to do in this book is to reorient that and ask a series of questions. And here are the questions that I just kind of jotted down today that I'm thinking of, that actually are kind of defining my search. What is this place we created? How did we create it? I'm talking about California and then the valley too. Are we truly hitting our limits? You know, you don't want to write a book that counts California out, because as soon as you count California out, it will surprise you. So we don't want to write a book titled Paradise Lost. I think right now my working title is Calamania, but it sounds too close to Victor Davis Hanson's Mexifornia, and I don't want to ever be in the same bed with Victor Davis Hanson. So are we hitting limits? The system that we built, it's actually two systems, were they a lie? Are we going to allow another period of drought to lead us to the overreach of water engineers and dam and tunnel builders? And we're not going to have a chronicle of drought in this book because flood's going to come soon enough. It always does. If you look at some of our worst droughts, you go back to the 1860s when all the cattle of California died, it was followed by an immense flood. And so flood's coming. That is the story of California. So I was up, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my travels. I was up near at the headwaters of the Sacramento, or at least what that little sign claims to be the headwaters. When I went and talked to the expert fisherman, he says, nah, the headwaters are way up in the Pitt River. That's where the headwaters are at. But this is where the water literally bubbles out from beneath Mount Shasta. And it's a religious experience for many people, I discovered. They go there, they pray. There's a Buddhist monastery there. They take their jugs of water and drop it into the thing and drink right out of it. It's supposed to be the purest water anywhere. And it's when you're drinking it, you're drinking water that is 50 years old. It's taken that long for the snow melt to come down into that cistern that is that volcano, come out and spring out and then go down the river. You name it, you give it your language, and the river becomes yours. Num ti pam alwa nem, ultima. That's what the Wintus and some of their other tribes named the Sacramento. Great water, over the hill water. Then the outsider came and named it the sacrament, approved by the church, petitioning the divine. So I'm thinking maybe the name you give something is the way you define your relationship to it. And we could say that the great water is a concession of man's smallness, that the river rules, and that when you start talking about sacraments, in the name of God, you conquer something, and now in the name of God, we're trying to engineer its repair. I say that because I was along the Sacramento River, about a month ago. There were 7 government agencies, federal, state there. They had 52,000 baby salmon that they were trying to imprint that part of the river onto them in that way that is so incredible, so hard to define. And they let them stay there for 3 days, and they put them in this huge tank that was aerated, and they lifted it up to let me see the salmon in there. And they were whirling around and spinning, and they put them in a 4x4 truck, and they were going to truck them downriver to a spot where they were hoping that they would migrate out. In other words, they were trying to skip the dead spot in the San Joaquin River. And this one woman who was heading the project said, those are my babies, 52,000 of them. And I said, how many do you think are going to come back? She said, well, if we're lucky, 10. So it got me wondering about a whole place kind of on steroids, you know. The farmer, in the midst of drought, planting ever more almonds. The sprawl boys coming right out of our bust, talking about the new towns that they're going to plant on the plains, Tejon Ranch in Madera, Newhall Ranch in the mountains that separate LA from the valley. And then the environmentalists trying to bring back something that is a Herculean task. And so, where did all this begin? Well, the native tribes, as light as they lived on the land, found a way to erect these small brush dams. They slowed down rivers, made the salmon sit still long enough to spear them. And then our 49ers came, and they were mining water every bit as they were mining gold. That becomes clear when you see the contrivances that they came up with to extract more out of California. And then this state decides, after the gold rush, to site its capital at the confluence of the American and the massive Sacramento. And what that begins is a tale of 70 years of flood and trying to conquer flood. And it's really fascinating how Sacramento did that. You know, bringing in enough dirt to turn the first story of every building in town into a second story. They literally lifted up the town of Sacramento and then all the levees and everything else. In those engineering reports that go back to the 1870s, 1880s, and then Meade comes out, and then the early Bureau comes out in the 1900s, you can see and you can hear the language where they're going to capture this river. And the notion is that any of it wasted going out to the ocean is a sin. I mean, literally, it's almost put in biblical terms. So we decide that we're going to capture these rivers even more. And we begin with the Sacramento because it's a problem. It's flooding. It's flooding all the time. And you follow certain books. Robert Kelly wrote an excellent book. I don't know if any of you have read that. You know, Battling the Inland Sea. Wonderful history on the way we captured the Sacramento. So the decision is that we're going to help with flooding, and then we're going to do something about moving the rain. I have this little book. It's a green book. It's the Central Valley Project, and it was written by the WPA writers. And the language is beautiful. I mean, it really captures the hubris of a time. And it's my dad's. And I started rereading it. And in there is this notion of moving the rain. And so it got me thinking. We took this landmass that's gargantuan, and we called it one state, California. And by calling it one state, then we kind of owned it. And we set out to even out its disparities. Well, to even out the disparities of this state is, I mean, how do you do that? There's so many disparities. But we decide that we're going to do that with the Central Valley Project. And if you look at that project, it's clearly built in the name of flood control and some navigation, but mostly it's to make this part of California bloom into an agricultural empire. That is why it was built. So when the city folk ask why 80% of California's water goes to ag, you need to go back and look at the conception of the Central Valley Project. I've been following a pistachio and almond grower who's a friend of mine. We go back to the seventh grade. He invited me to his pistachio grove as winter turned to spring. And he said, there's something very odd going on with my pistachios. Well, pistachios don't pollinate in the way, we don't have to bring in bees to pollinate them like you do for the almond. They self-pollinate. So in a field or a grove or an orchard, you will see all these trees laid out, and then every so often you'll see one tree with its trunk painted red. And that is the male. So for every one male, there's 25 females. It's a wonderful harem, okay? And that one guy's got to take care of 25, okay? So my friend says, something's going wrong. The women are all ready, and the men are nowhere to be found. I said, what else is new? So he started going around with a stick, and he was hitting the women and then hitting the men, and they were off. And he said, so what do you attribute this to? He says, I've never seen it in 30 years. He says, it's climate change. We had just come out of this spring that was just I mean, this winter that was like spring. There weren't enough chilling hours to chill. In fact, I've got an apricot tree in my backyard, three of them. And I had so many apricots a few years ago, I made Armenian sun jam. It was great stuff. This year, the fruit set, but then it all shed. So I called my brother-in-law, the farmer. I said, did I do something wrong? He said, no, there are just no chilling hours to put that tree in hibernation. And so it's going to shed. So we're going to have a year this year where those who haven't turned their fruit trees into almonds here are going to have a light year, which means their price for their crop is going to go up. But we're going to have a hard time getting tree fruit this year because of this. So my buddy said, it's climate change. And I said, well, what are you going to do about it? And he said, come out tomorrow. So I went out the next day, and two dune buggies were flying up and down the pistachios. And these dune buggies were equipped with basically what a gardener does the blowing with. And out being blown was male pistachio. He was artificially inseminating his field. He got a hell of a crop. Farming is full of manipulations, and it's cruel. And it's cruel all the way back to when my grandfather came here after hiding in that attic in Istanbul 100 years ago to survive the Armenian genocide. We have gluts followed by busts, gluts followed by busts. If you talk to the almond guy, he believes that his crop will be the first crop that won't hit a glut. If you talk to Stuart Resnick, he believes it too. And they may be right. They may have found the first crop that won't have a glut, but I don't think so. It's going to happen, and they will be tearing out almond trees, not because of drought, just because of the market. So it's a crazy thing that's going on. And what I've done is I've slowed down the Central Valley Project, and I've tried to understand its rationale. And I can understand the first part of it. We're going to control this river that floods all the time because we built our capital in the floodplain. So, and it's got so much excess that we're going to send some of that water south to the San Joaquin Valley where they've got this incredible soil, but they need some more water. I can understand those two parts of it. What I can't understand is the killing of the San Joaquin River then. Because here's what happened. Many of you know this. They bring the water in, here's the north. They bring the water in from the Sacramento through the Delta to a place called the Mendota. It's a lake. It's like the pool, the Mendota Pool. And there they use it as a wheeling station. And then in the name of instead of sending it all the way down the valley like the aqueduct did years later, they decide to stop it right there. Now the question becomes is, okay, we've sent some water from the Sacramento to the San Joaquin Valley, and that will help some farmland. But that's not going to get all the way along the east side of the valley to the citrus belt, and it's not going to get down to the south valley to Kern. Because let's remember something, and this is what outsiders always forget. This is not one valley. This is actually three valleys. And that conflation a lot of times by outsiders creates some problems. You start painting this place with one broad brush and you start making it all evil. There's actually a whole swath of agriculture, the Center Valley, I call it, along 99, which is very sustainable agriculture. The water table is high. There's lots of diverse farms. And there's great communities like Fowler, where I found Harry Rustigan, that are more or less like the Jeffersonian kind of ideal of farming. Not quite, but close. Then you've got the east side, the citrus belt. Beautiful. It couldn't be more different than the west side. There's actual communities there. And the children of the farmers go to school with the children of the farm workers. And the schools are pretty darn good. Exeter, Lindsay, Strathmore, Orange Cove. Poverty, yes, but kind of sustainable way where you could see ag kind of penciling out until you add water in, and we'll talk about that. And then we have the west side. And the west side is diverse too. You could divide it into three places. There's the Westlands Water District, which everyone demonizes. Then there's West Plains. And then there's farming all along the west side, all the way to Lost Hills. And Lost Hills and that farmland in Kern didn't exist until the 60s. But that takes us to the State Water Project, and we want to focus still on the Central Valley Project. So, what they decided to do is kill the San Joaquin River and send its flow against the grain in defiance of gravity 160 miles south along the east side citrus belt to the Kern River. And that, to me, right now sitting here, was the great mistake of the Central Valley Project, its overreach. If you look back and you freeze time before the building of the Central Valley Project, you will see in the 1930s we had a six-year drought. It was from the 20s to 30s, not unlike this one. And farmers who had planted citrus along the east side and farmers who were planting cotton and potatoes into Kern, and some of these were big boys, because remember, this valley, the farming started off big. It started off with Miller and Lux. It started off with Ollie Ben Hagen, okay? It started off with Lloyd Tevis. These were San Francisco people, industrialists who came here and essentially bought riparian land and owned the movements of rivers and land. The Kern County Land Company, hundreds of thousands of acres, was essentially the Hagen Empire. So it started off big. And we have these farmers saying we're going dry because our pumps can't reach down into the aquifer. And the aquifer on the east side, that east valley, the citrus belt, is poor. The groundwater generally is not as good as it is in the center valley. It's rocky and it's very hit and miss. But they tapped into these rivers and they developed some agriculture. And the Mulhollands and others from the San Francisco came up and over the mountain. Gillette, the razor guy, they all had citrus land along the east side. And they were going dry. And they needed surface water to continue. Actual irrigation districts went out of business in the 30s. If we look back in Monday morning quarterback, maybe we say that that farming, if it could not be sustained by its rivers, maybe didn't deserve to be farmed. And then you go into Kern and you ask the same question. If you can't farm your local watershed and you must go and reach beyond, maybe you shouldn't be farming that extra land. But we killed the San Joaquin River, brought that river water down, and it revived that agriculture. The Central Valley Project kept saying that we're only looking to save 500,000 to 700,000 acres. Well, they saved that 500,000 acres. But then what happened is, because the system allowed it, we saw an intensification of new land then being developed. And now we're back in the same place we were in the 30s and 40s, where we've got a lot of farmland, a lot of farmers farming marginal land because of the availability of water. And so what are we going to do? Do we let them go dry? And to me, the worst time to devise solutions to things is in the midst of drought. And that's what we're planning to do. We're looking at the twin tunnels and other things. A new dam up Temperance Flat. And if we listen to history, we will see that the building of these things in the midst of drought to answer the call of farming has tended to be a mistake. Where are we at on time, Roger?
We can go a little bit.
How much time? We got 5 minutes, and I'm going to open up for questions. So here's the deal. when you get close to the land with these guys, it's very hard to maintain your point of view. It gets messed up and complicated. And if this book does anything, I hope it arrives at that messy middle and it screws with everybody's, you know, conceptions of things. So I go to the west side, and this is, you know, when you look at the zero-sum game that's happening now, you know, farmers are going to be throwing other farmers under the bus. The almond guys who took it on the chin now for about the last 6-8 weeks, if not more, going back to the Mother Jones piece, they're now going to throw the alfalfa boys under the bus, okay? And the alfalfa boys are going to have a hard time here because the almond guy, 1 gallon per nut. Absurd that we measure things that way. Food takes water, okay? We won't get into what a soybean requires, okay, for all you vegetarians. But this is the zero-sum game. And now the alfalfa guys, I just read a letter that an alfalfa guy sent the almond guy saying, you know, you're starting to go in that way, and please don't do that because we can't be warring among ourselves. Well, the almond guy wanted to write back but didn't, said, where were you 6 weeks ago when I was taking it on the chin? 2 million acres of alfalfa and silage are grown in the state of California. They could be grown anywhere, unlike the almond, which could only be grown here. They go principally to feed dairy cattle for milk, milk that's in a surplus that also has a subsidy. So the dairy guy is going to have a tough time trying to now justify his water footprint, because that's where we're at. We're in now a time of not just carbon footprints, but water footprints. So as you're puzzling out a solution to all this, we're going to see that scarcity, even if flood comes, we're in a period of scarcity. Let's face it, we're 40 million people. We've industrialized agriculture to a point where we can't anymore. So we're going to have to make some choices. This magnificent system that we built, the Central Valley Project and the State Water Project, allowed us to maximize sprawl and farming. But I think we've come to a place where we may have to stop. So when you go on the west side and you hang out with Mr. Wolf, 97 years old, and he owns 25,000 acres of land around the valley, and you want to call him a corporate farmer, and yet he's 97 watching his tomatoes get planted, and on the wall are his 25 children and grandchildren, each with a 960-acre allotment of land. It screws with your ideas of things, okay? It's not so easy. Now, those 25 kids on the wall aren't all farming. Some are off in Madagascar and doing some other things. But it's a family farming operation. I don't know. So this is what I'm in the middle of. I'm not sure I'm going to emerge in February with a manuscript. I can't, though, continue to get swallowed up. Nothing's been written like this since probably Rivers of Empire by Worcester, University of Kansas professor. And I hope that being a native gives me a different kind of perspective, because I'm going to weave my own family's farming story into this too. So we'll see how it ends up.